Rich Kimble, Carrie Haskell with you. And joining us in studio, a professor at the University of Maine, media historian, and author of the book 6 Minutes in Berlin, Broadcast Spectacle and Rowing Gold at the Nazi Olympics, Michael Sokolow. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.
And we would like to think maybe biggest claim to fame is that our friend Brian Stackpole, a former student of yours.
That's right. Brian was great. And I'm glad to follow his career trajectory.
Well, I've been following you on Twitter for some time and have enjoyed your thoughts there and reading a lot of your work in a number of publications. One that's coming up, you've got something coming up in Slate very soon, right?
I do. I have to be careful about how I preview it. It has to do with the Super Bowl, but not the Patriots. Mm. And a player from the 1970s who's been forgotten, who's very important.
Excellent. All right. Well, we won't press you for any more, but we'll look for that in Slate. And is that coming up next week that it'll be out?
We're going into final edit tomorrow, and then I'm not sure. Maybe over the weekend or Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah. All right. Well, I wanted to talk about a piece that you wrote back in the fall for the Boston Globe, because it's bears discussing again with Elizabeth Warren's announcement that she's running for president. And it was a really interesting piece about how Elizabeth Warren could take some advice by following the lead of all people, George Foreman.
Yeah, I wrote that piece. Actually, that piece came out of a different, a sort of different place, which was about George Foreman being the master of the second act in American history. Because people forget, there was that great Academy Award-winning movie with him and Ali about the Rumble in the Jungle, When We Were Kings. And people forget how many different people George Foreman has been in his life. I know that sounds strange, but he won the gold medal as a teenager in 1968, and he became way too famous way too quickly. It soured him. And then he became a heavyweight champion, patterning himself after Sonny Liston. Then he became this gospel preacher. And then he started selling grills. And then he accomplished, which to me is one of the most amazing athletic feats of the 20th century, regaining the heavyweight championship at 46 years old. I don't think there's anything comparable to that, frankly. I had thought about George Foreman and identity in that way. It's so interesting that he's lived so many lives. And then Elizabeth Warren did this DNA test, which you know, you can think what you want about it, but it really is about finding your identity and that kind of thing.
Well, and as you mentioned in the piece, both Elizabeth Warren and George Foreman have what you describe as messy family histories.
Exactly. And I think it's very difficult to live that out in public, really difficult to live that out in public. It takes an extraordinary human being, frankly, which I think is one of the points of the piece. Another successful person in that way was Bill Clinton. You know, people right. talk about how his father had died in the truck accident. He was raised, you know, his name was Blythe, and is raised by this other person and everything. And he navigated that. But it's very hard to find people who have this kind of messy personal history who are running for president or heavyweight championships in the world and navigating identity so brilliantly.
And I had forgotten a little bit about the early days of Foreman and what he went through, the grief he took. We've had John Carlos on the show before talking about his protest at the 68 Olympics, but I've forgotten the fallout that happened when George Foreman, in his exuberance, wrapped himself in the American flag.
It's incredible, isn't it, to think about? And I think the only Olympics where anybody could have gotten in trouble waving an American flag were 1968. And it was just a sort of a bad combination of things. It wasn't just 1968. It was the world's first live global television broadcast. They had been planning literally for 4 years to show around the world. So Foreman's audience waving that flag right after the protest was in the hundreds of millions. And it's not like he could go back. The other thing is, and again, people forget this, he was 19 years old and he had been boxing for less than 14 months. I mean, he won the Olympic gold medal in something like his 19th fight ever. Which, I mean, again, as an athlete, and I do sports and sports broadcasting history, as an athlete, I find him in some ways without parallel in that way.
You tweeted a while back and reminded me of a guy that I remember from my youth as an NFL fan, Bob Kuchenberg, and what a great story he had in his, when you talk about family stories. Can you talk a little bit about Cooch's dad and the advice that he got along the way?
There were so many excellent obituaries of him. And for those of you who don't remember him, and also don't remember, now this is about when I started watching football, the Miami Dolphins were the greatest team ever assembled. They went to 3 straight Super Bowls. they were dominant in a way that very few teams have been. I mean, I guess maybe the Steelers and the Patriots, the 49ers, but just to get to three consecutive Super Bowls and win two very easily and have an undefeated season is incredible. And it was all because of their offensive line. Two of the guys are in the Hall of Fame already, and Kuchenberg deserves to be there. So there are a lot of – but the interesting thing is he was undersized, and the obituaries had all these funny stories about him. The one quote I liked, which I didn't tweet out, is Don Shula said, just don't try to figure out Cooch. But the New York Times really went deep on it, and they said his father had been a rodeo clown. His father was a steel worker, but he made extra money as a rodeo clown and a human cannonball in the circus. And when Kuchenberg got the scholarship offer to Notre Dame, his father sat him down and said, look, you have a choice. Either you graduate from Notre Dame or you get in the cannon.
I love that story. We're talking with Michael Sokolow here on Downtown. You are a media historian, and we're on a historic frequency. We had the 90th anniversary of this AM 620 frequency back in the fall, and I believe back in the day when they first affiliated, this station was part of the NBC network.
No, actually, it's fascinating. 620, and I don't mean to correct you on this, because I happen to be writing a chapter on Maine radio for a book I'm doing.
Oh, fantastic.
And so I've done research into 620, and it was started by Guernsey Thompson in Dover Foxcroft, a University of Maine engineer in 1926. And it was the first radio station in this whole area, and it went up to the Maritimes and all this, and it was a fascinating story. But what's amazing to me is this was one of the original 12 CBS affiliates. When CBS was a company that failed called United Independent Broadcasters in 1927, and it was purchased by the Paley, and it was redone and whatever, and became Columbia Phonograph Broadcasting System because it was designed to do records only. And Guernsey Thompson was one of the original 12.
Wow.
Of CBS. And CBS's 90th anniversary is this September, and I plan to write something about it because I think 620 is amazing.
Yeah, I actually was going to say, I have an ink blotter from the big promotional push when they switched over to NBC, which was in...
Decades later, I think it was.
Yeah, well, 40s. Guernsey was still part of the... was still involved with the station at the time.
Right. Well, I actually heard that he used to come in here right through the 1970s and read his paper. And say, by then, it had been sold to the Rhines family, I think, and it had been changed hands and stuff. But it's a great story. I mean, it's a sort of a sad story. I don't know if you know the story about the WLBZ television license that he was one of the pre-war television people, and he sunk a ton of money into Boston TV, and then the war hits. Can't sell the advertising. NBC swoops in, gets his license, and all that stuff. You know, the University of Maine has a really terrific WLBZ collection that was saved from this building, and I've been using some of that as well.
Oh, wow. Well, it was on these airwaves that one of the most famous radio broadcasts of all time, 1938, the War of the Worlds broadcast.
Except I'm somebody who if you Google me and you Google War of the Worlds, you'll see I've done a ton of scholarship on the fact that there was no panic. I'm the person that snopes sites. Yes, sorry about that.
No.
I don't want to get you angry. But you can look it up. You can look it up at Slate. I had a very long piece at Slate. It's been cited a lot.
Now I have to read that.
A lot of saying their stuff. It's greatly exaggerated. It was the 80th anniversary this past October.
Right.
And basically the newspapers made it a huge thing. But you know that all of New England, the panic was known to have been significantly less. Because WEEI out of Boston was CBS's biggest affiliate in New England, and they ran a local program. They didn't run War of the Worlds. Anyway, if you War of the Worlds has been a little research hobby of mine for the last decade.
Well, because I teach history as well, and I'd always used as reference old articles that I'd found on microfilm from the Bangor Daily News. Are you telling me that they might have embellish some of those stories 80 years ago, Mike?
Well, here's the key. And it's funny that you say that as a historian, because this is what you have to do with primary sources, okay? Are there names attached to the people who are panicked? The biggest single issue with the panic reports is it was a giant game of telephone. People were saying, oh, I heard this group of people. Oh, I heard this. Oh, I heard that. There were no names. There was no attribution. I even, I tried to track down people in the 1940 census based on articles from the 1938. Let's put it this way. The most famous study of War of the Worlds by Hadley Kentrill called, I forget the title of the book, but it came out in 1940. It was the most in-depth study He reviewed 12,000 newspaper articles, and he came up with less than six names of people who actually, you know, self-reported fear.
And me and Rich have talked about this on the air before, I think around the date of the anniversary of the broadcast. My dad listened to that. My dad was born in 26, and he remembered listening to that. So when I was in school and going through, you know, I have a degree in broadcasting, and talking about stuff like that with my father, he goes, yeah, I never understood what the whole panic was about, because if you listen to the show, they said it was a show. It was the, on the same time that it always is. And so he was living up in Lincoln at the time. But yeah, he sort of said the same thing, that there was no real panic as far as he was concerned, because, you know, it was a show he listened to on the radio.
And it had commercial breaks. You know, yes, if the right. world was ending, you wouldn't throw in a commercial. You know, there were a lot of funny aspects to it. You know, in part of my research, I came across the CBS chief researcher's papers at the Library of Congress, and I found a study that was totally unpublished, and I plan to do something with this, because everybody says, well, the reason everybody panicked was the dial twisting. Was, you know, they tuned in from the number one show, they came into the middle of these radio
which
reports.
Which was Edgar Bergen, right?
Exactly. It's called the Chase and Sanborn Hour. And it turned out that Nielsen had put a brand new minute-by-minute audience analysis tape machine type thing into 250 homes that were stratified and representational in the Midwest for the Chase and Sanborn Hour, not for, because it was the number one show on the air at the time. And what they recorded is that the audience kept climbing through the first commercial, because the song, when everybody supposedly tuned out, because you got into the skits. When the song ended, you got into the skits. And people, that's what people were tuning in for. Where the audience completely drops off is the second song, 40 minutes into the Chase and Sanborn show, because they know the skits were wrapping up and the show was ending. So it's a complicated question, but I wrote a big piece in Slate in 2013 on the fact that there was no panic.
I'm going to read that tonight. I can't wait. That's great stuff. Michael Sokolow with us from the University of Maine. You're an expert on the history of networks, so let's look into the future a little bit. Where are we going? Broadcasting almost seems like an anachronism now, because everything is aimed at such a small target audience. Where do you see this going, first of all, for the big traditional networks? How can they continue to be successful in this brave new world?
Well, first I want to just quibble slightly with one thing you're saying. Broadcasting is doing better than almost any other medium, right? We just saw with the Huffington Post. We just saw with BuzzFeed. We saw all these layoffs that are happening right now, and layoffs in the newspapers with Gannett. But broadcasting, do you know that radio, what we're doing right now, is still the number one medium in the United States,
oh,
according
yeah.
to Pew.
They've been trying to kill off radio since, well, since television.
Right. 91% of American adults tune into radio in any given week. That's the largest usage of any medium that exists. And it's 100 years old in 2020.
Right.
And if you look at cable news, right, everybody's talking about Fox News, CNN, all this stuff. Part of it is because the president puts a spotlight on it. But you know that the CBS Evening News is today, CBS Evening News' audience on any given night is three times larger than Fox's at their best. Fox News at their best. You know, things like the Citizens United decision has flooded the political airwaves. So broadcasting is actually doing, and Sinclair and the purchases and the exchange of all these stations is a complicated question. But of all the media, broadcasting is actually stable and plateauing relative to everything else. Now the future, that's the trillion-dollar question, hundreds of billion-dollar question of broadcasting. You know, I'm interested with the Super Bowl coming up, the Super Bowl, the Academy Awards, the big shows. When are they going to be pay-per-view? When are they going to start moving in that direction because of the rights fees and that kind of thing? I mean, you know about ESPN and cord cutting. ESPN has totally changed the dynamics of sports,
right,
and nobody can afford it anymore. And so these are the kind of questions but I'm not sure when it's going to happen or how it's going to happen, but it's, but broadcasting is healthier right now. And we have to be honest. I mean, going through November, last October, November, right, a station like this is going to make a fortune, not just this station, but all the stations in Bangor on political advertising.
Right.
And that's going to keep growing.
What do you have there, Kerry? What did you bring in?
Just so when we were finished, the ink blotter I was talking about, I grabbed it off
wonderful.
My bulletin board. I didn't want to forget it.
I wanted to bring up this, too, before we let you go, because you tweeted about it earlier, a piece that's, I believe, in The Atlantic today about the reaction to the students from Covington Catholic and someone making the claim that the media blew this one, and you disputed that and laid the blame, I think, where it truly belongs, which is on all of us as consumers.
Yeah, I think it's really far too easy, and this actually is related to War of the Worlds, right? The question about War of the Worlds is, why do we think everybody was so easily scared? Why do we devalue the audience's role in that story? Because Orson Welles was a genius, and there was no other genius like that ever before. The audience probably reacted pretty well to War of the Worlds, and in this case, the audience probably didn't react real well to these videos. But the key is, you know, we're living in a society of the spectacle. People have described this. We're getting snippets. There's no context. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know now, and I would strongly recommend your audience or people who are interested in this to look up the CNN report on this. We know that the original tweet of the original small clip, not the long videos, not the longer thing, came from an account that Twitter has since suspended that was foreign, that used a picture, those Getty images, the stock photo.
Yes.
Use a stock photo for the person. Twitter suspended it because it was from abroad, and they think it's Brazil, I think they said. They don't know exactly. And it got 2.5 million shares, that original small snippet. And then the bots came into it, you know, the Russian bots and stuff. And so the amount of outrage, there's this concept that I'm just beginning to look at, and I'm not sure what to do with, you know, called outrage sharing and unintended amplification. And this seems to be just an incredible case of this, where nobody's willing to wait and think about it.
Right. And that brings up a point we've talked about. We had Molly McHugh on, who's an expert on media manipulation. And how do you become a better, smarter consumer? And it begins with not sharing the moment you see something, finding out the origin of the material that angers and outrages you, and just taking a deep breath first.
Yeah, I had a piece in the New York Times last March called How to Prevent Smart People from Spreading Dumb Ideas. And the point was exactly those three things. Number one, no link, it's not news. So immediately, if there isn't a link to a respected journalism outlet, you don't share it, don't retweet it. It's not news until the link is there. The second thing is, if you agree with it, you have to understand your feed has been curated and manipulated by Twitter and Facebook to make you agree with it, to get you to share it more. So if you agree with it, that's when you should be skeptical. And number three, my third point was, wait, why am I talking? Ask yourself before you retweet, before you take part in something, what do I have to add to this conversation? Instead of just mindlessly, quickly engaging, which is what Facebook and Twitter does. They get paid by engagement. So they're encouraging you to not think about it and just do that.
Why do we, and you know, that I say we, why do all of us feel the need to latch on to stories like that and express our opinion so quickly?
You know, again, billion-dollar answer, because that's what engagement is. I am convinced that there is a certain level of sort of neurochanneling and neurolinguistic programming in our brains that we get a little hit of endorphin, or it makes us feel as though we're participating in a certain way. What nobody talks about with social media is just how emotional it is. Like when you find out somebody's unfollowed you, or when you find out you've been blocked, or exactly, you actually feel it a little bit, which is such a strange concept. When you read the newspaper in the old days, even if somebody said your basketball team played terribly or you did something like that, it didn't have the same personal feeling. It's a very strange thing.
No question about that. Michael, it's great to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming in this afternoon. We'll be able to catch up with you in Australia. That's where you're headed next?
That's right. I got a 31-hour trip on Saturday. Wow. I'll be at the News and Media Research Center at the University of Canberra for the next 6 months.
Wow. What's the time difference?
16 hours. They're already into tomorrow.
Great. All right. We'll have to have you back on from Australia and figure out that time difference and make it work.
Yeah, I'll call you from tomorrow.
That sounds great. Thanks so much for coming in. Michael Sokolow here on Downtown.